We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short, and this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Mind the Kids podcast from the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, known as ACAM. Today, the key question is, what do reward learning and anhedonia tell us about how young people respond to rewards as they move through adolescence? I'm Mark Tebbs, I'm your host for today. I spent my whole career working in mental health, from frontline service delivery to director of mental health commissioning. I'm currently a chief executive of charity, and I'm a trustee of a mental health organisation and also a career coach. I'm really pleased to be hosting these podcasts. It gives me the opportunity to speak to some of the kind of leading clinicians and academics in the kind of forefront of children and young people's mental health. So if you're a clinician, if you're an educator, a parent, or just curious about mental health, I hope these discussions lead you with some fresh insights and practical tools to help. Don't forget to subscribe where you get your podcast from, and also on your YouTube channel, just search ACAMH and you'll find us across all socials. Today I'm joined by Dr. Holly Sullivan Toole, who is based in the University of Minnesota and working out of the Masonic Institute for the Developing Brain. We'll be discussing her recent research published in ACAM's Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry about reward learning, anhedonia, and how young people update their expectations based on rewards and losses. We'll also explore what the findings may tell us about adolescent development and what might happen when reward processing is blunted. So let's get started. Welcome, Holly. It's an absolute pleasure to be speaking with you today.
Yeah, nice to be here, Mark. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk about this work.
Brilliant. Really looking forward to the podcast. So we'll start with a little bit of background, just kind of set the scene a little bit. So who did you collaborate with on the paper?
Yeah, it was a great team. The second author here, Jeremy Haynes, he took the lead in developing the computational model specifically for this task, with our other computational collaborator, Nathaniel Haynes, who had developed like the original computational model for the Iowa gambling task. This work was out of the lab of Dr. Thomas Olino at Temple University, who led this big longitudinal development study looking at adolescent risk for depression.
Great stuff. As part of the kind of preparation for the podcast, I was reading a little bit about reward learning and anhedonia. So could you just kind of tell us what those are and why they're so important for your study?
Yeah. So broadly, anhedonia is just sort of blunted or decreased response to rewards in the environment. So not enjoying, for example, food or time with friends, or not sort of looking forward to it. And anhedonia is this transdiagnostic symptom that is found across multiple disorders. It's found in depression. It's found in some instances of psychosis, in social anxiety. And it's actually a pretty serious symptom. It's associated with worse outcomes, mental health outcomes long term. It's pretty resistant to the current treatments we have. And it's predictive of the onset of depression, for example. And so it's a really important symptom that we need to understand better. Officially in the DSM, it's defined as a lack of interest or a lack of pleasure in normally rewarding activities. But researchers are really digging deep into this concept. And I think we're really still in the process of understanding exactly which components of reward processing are affected in anhedonia. So is it primarily interest in rewards and motivation for rewards? Or is it enjoying the rewards once you get them? Animal models and some emerging work in humans have shown these are kind of different things. And you might have one of these processes could be really intact. You might enjoy rewards once you get them. You enjoy eating the ice cream, but you just don't have any motivation to go out and you don't want to put your boots on and walk out in the cold and go to the store and get the ice cream. So there's these different processes that make up this big idea of reward responsivity. And a really important one that hasn't been studied nearly as much is how do we learn about rewards? Again, you might sort of, if someone just puts the ice cream in front of you, you might enjoy it. But are you sort of learning when I hang out with these friends, it's an ice cream party. And when I hang out with these friends, it's, you know, a broccoli party. I don't know. So yeah, how we actually sort of like update our expectations to like seek out rewards in the environment. We don't know a lot about that. And we're really just trying to figure out which of these processes are like most impacted in anhedonia. And so it's like a really exciting time to be working in this area.
Brilliant. So as I understand, there's kind of almost like two core parts to the study. There's the looking about how reward-specific learning changes during adolescence, and then the impact of risk of depression on that process. What was kind of like known about young people learning from rewards during adolescence beforehand? And what were you hoping to learn from this study?
There's a considerable body of evidence showing that like reward responsivity is sort of increased during adolescence. There's evidence of like heightened brain activation in reward regions when adolescents are like anticipating a reward or receiving a reward. We generally see more activation in adolescents than children or adults. Mm-hmm. And there's evidence of like greater behavioral reward seeking and risk taking in adolescents. And this sort of corresponds to what we know from like animal models showing that the dopamine system, which is known to support different aspects of reward responsivity, particularly like incentive motivation, we know that the dopamine system undergoes like substantial development in adolescence. So we know just generally that like reward responsivity seems to be heightened, but in terms of like reward learning specifically, less is known, particularly when it comes to like different components of reward learning, like learning from rewards versus learning from punishments. And the findings that we do have from the existing studies are kind of mixed. And I think what complicates the story is that the studies that have been done have used really different learning tasks. And we know that like the best way to learn from rewards is actually like really dependent on the specific environment or the specific demands of the task. So for example, updating your expectations or learning a lot when you get a reward, that might help you be successful like in one environment or one behavioral task, but in another task or another environment, it might hurt you. Like if you're updating too strongly when you get rewards. And maybe if that updating for rewards sort of outweighs the amount that you're updating when you encounter a loss. So maybe in some environments, learning too strongly from rewards can be a bad thing. But what does seem to be emerging from these sort of mixed findings is that adolescents like seem to be like tuning their reward learning in ways that support like performing tasks better. So I was really expecting to learn something very global, like about the ways adolescents learn from rewards in like a global sense. But as I've like come to understand that the components of reward learning sort of support optimal task performance on different tasks in different ways. And as I've like thought more about the specific task that we've used, I began to realize there's just a lot to learn about reward learning and it's complicated. But I do think our study made like a contribution towards like understanding how reward learning may become like really fine-tuned across adolescence in a way that like supports mature functioning.
Great stuff. So we'll get into a little bit more of that kind of details and the kind of results and implications in a moment. I think it'd be really good just to kind of set the scene a little bit more, particularly about kind of how you kind of went about the study. So, you know, who took part, kind of... what was the kind of age range of the kind of people in the study?
So our participants were drawn from Dr. Tom Olino's Temple Adolescent Development Study. We call it TADS. And the study is based out of Temple University in Philadelphia. TADS was a longitudinal study of development of reward function in adolescents and the role of reward system development in relation to emerging psychopathology. The study started with kids aged 9 to 14, and we followed them for 3 years. And the data set's really rich. It contains like a lot of measures, but like a major focus of the study was the role of the developing reward system in the emergence of depression. So we excluded like kids who had parents with a history of bipolar disorder or psychotic spectrum disorder. And we excluded kids with learning disabilities, neurological illnesses, developmental disabilities like autism spectrum, just because that wasn't really the focus of the study. So I specifically analyzed data using the Iowa gambling task, and we had about just over 200 kids who completed this task at baseline at the beginning of the study. And then we followed them for about 3 years. We got the kids to complete the task like 5 times, spaced about 9 months apart. And by the end of the study, our kids were 17. So we have this data set covering like a really large span of adolescence from about 9 to 17 years old. And since the study was based out of Temple University, which is located in North Philadelphia, we were able to recruit like a really racially and ethnically diverse sample, which I think is really cool. So out of like the 79% of the kids who reported their race, about 59% reported a racial minority status. So it's a really cool data set, I think.
Yeah, amazing. And then, so you mentioned the Iowa gambling task. So what was that? Tell us kind of what the kids were doing.
Sure. The original Iowa gambling task is this game where participants see like 4 decks of cards on the screen, like a sort of virtual card game, and they choose a card from a deck, you know, take a deck A, deck B, C, and then they get monetary rewards and losses based on their choices. And the participants aren't really given any information about the outcomes associated with the different cards, but they can just sort of learn by sampling. Two of the decks are good and lead to net monetary wins, and two of the decks are bad and lead to net losses. But in the original version, as a researcher, you can't really tease apart whether people are making their choices because they like the rewards or because they dislike the punishments. Mm-hmm. So we use this kind of different version that allows us to like experimentally break apart approaching rewards and avoiding punishments. We call it the player pass IGT. The kids still see all 4 decks of cards from the original task. But instead of them sort of freely choosing, we just sort of give them a deck. We say like, here on this trial, you get deck B. And do you want to play on it and see whether you get those rewards or losses? Or do you want to pass on it and just nothing happens and you get a new choice? And it's a pretty cool task. We can look at how much they choose to play on the good decks. And that's like a measure of approaching rewards. Or we can look at how much they choose to pass on the bad decks. And that's a measure of avoiding punishment. So just as a researcher, it's a really cool behavioral task. For the participants, it's like a hard game, but I think it can be frustrating because you're kind of like winning money and you think you're doing well. And then you kind of get hit with a big monetary loss.
Okay. So in the original task, it was like random. You could choose between the 4 different decks, but you kind of gave them one deck. And then how did that change the, you know, what you were learning from the experiment?
Yeah. So, I mean, this task, what we're calling the player pass IGT was specifically designed to give you those separate measurements from, for approaching rewards and avoiding punishments, which is really cool. You kind of can't separate those things in the original task. And we know these are like separate systems. So they're really cool measures to get.
Okay. Right. Yeah. So what did you find? You know, what were the kind of like the changes that you saw as the young people kind of got older?
When we sort of just looked at what we can observe directly from the task. When we looked at the choices our participants made in the game, we see like a subtle increase in adolescents playing from the good decks or more approaching reward as they get older. And we see like a subtle decrease in them passing on the bad decks or like avoiding punishments as they get older. But those separate effects that this game was designed to tease apart, those separate effects weren't statistically significant. So it's really, we really only saw the effect of kids. We did see an effect of kids just generally playing the game better as they got older. But we only really sort of see that effect when we put like approaching reward and avoiding punishment together. Okay. And then that was significant when we sort of look at this measure that we can directly observe.
Okay, so as young people kind of get older, their kind of approach to the game gets more sophisticated, and that they both avoid punishments and seek rewards. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. We're definitely seeing that.
Okay, right. Yeah. So, and the kind of computational model, the computational modeling, which parts of learning actually changed around adolescence?
We were really interested in looking at, like I said, reward and punishment like separately. And the cool thing about the model is it gives us another way to look at that, which was handy since we didn't sort of see those effects in purely based on the choices that they made. But our model lets us like break apart the different processes in reward learning. So the reinforcement learning model that we used, it was developed specifically for this POP IGT game. It's developed by a group led by my colleague, Jeremy Haynes. We call it the Player Pass Outcome Representation Learning Model, or the POP ORL model. And it allows us to break down participants' choice behavior that we can directly observe. We can count the choices. It lets us break that into component parts. And specifically, it gives us a measure of reward learning rate and punishment learning rate. And this tells us how much people are sort of like updating in reaction to each little reward or each little punishment. But the model also gives us a measure of like win-loss frequency sensitivity. And that tells us how much people update their expectations based on how often they get a reward. So not the size of the reward, not the magnitude of the reward, but just like how frequently it's occurring. And then finally, we get a measure of go bias. And that's just how often they generally choose to play. Like how often are they hitting play versus pass? So of these like four measures that our model gives us, it's pretty cool. We specifically saw significant developmental change across adolescents in the two measures that are related to reward processing specifically. So we saw developmental changes in reward learning rate and in the win frequency effect, but not in punishment learning rate and not in go bias.
What did you find about reward learning rates?
We found that reward learning rate decreased in our task across adolescents. And so like that might be seem sort of surprising because I've sort of said, you know, earlier that we see enhanced reward responsivity in adolescents, and yet we found developmental decreases in reward learning rate. And I think that's because reward learning rate is like this really nuanced construct. It's basically a measure of how volatile learning from rewards is. And I think when you use that word volatile, it makes a lot more sense like what reward learning rate is. It's basically like how dramatically a person updates their expectations based on like each little reward that they get. So we might be tempted to think like more learning is better, right? We want higher reward learning rates, like the more the better. But in general, we actually want to see learning rates that are like somewhere in the middle. We want to see people who are updating not too much and not too little, but like just right, like that sweet spot. Also, the optimal learning rate really depends on the environment or the demands of the task. Here in the Iowa gambling task, you get better performance when you have a relatively lower reward learning rate. And that's because like rewards are pretty distracting in this game. If you're just sort of only paying attention to like, oh, I got $100, I got $100, I got $100, and you kind of don't pay attention to, oh, I just got hit with like $1,000 loss, you're not going to do well in the task. So on the surface, it might seem like these developmental decreases in reward learning rates, like contradicting what we know about like the reward system sort of being amped up in adolescence. But it's actually consistent with like the optimization of reward learning across adolescence.
Okay, so the decrease is actually being more appropriate and sensitive to the task demands in a kind of like in an optimal way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Amazing. Yeah. So the other part of your study was about the impact of kind of risk of depression. So should we talk a little bit about that now? Is there anything else you wanted to say about the kind of normative adolescent learning?
We also found that the effect of win frequency sensitivity was increasing across adolescents. It's a pretty interesting measure. It's sensitivity to like how often a reward occurs, but it's ignoring the size of the reward. And again, it's really that measure is really dependent on the environment or the task demands. So specifically in this task, it can be adaptive to sort of ignore the magnitude of rewards. Because for example, our deck A gives you these high magnitude rewards, but like small frequent losses, and it sort of leaves you with a net loss. And specifically in this task, it's better to have higher sensitivity to the frequency of rewards. And that is what we're seeing in our adolescents as they get older. So again, we're seeing something that sort of suggests they're like tuning their reward learning to for sort of optimal performance in the game.
Okay. So the learning is both in terms of the frequency and the magnitude of the learning. So the adolescents are having to kind of evaluate these kind of combined effects on what the overall optimal strategy is.
Yeah. And I think sort of ignore features of the environment that may not be informative for optimal performance. So sort of ignoring the size of the reward because the frequency in this case is really informative.
Rightio. Okay. Rightio. And then, so the other bit was this kind of like the impact of risk of depression. So why did you want to include that within the study?
So that's sort of like my core interest in this reward learning stuff is sort of how do these processes go awry and how does that confer risk for depression? So we specifically looked at whether the kids' moms had a history of depression because history of depression is a really or parental history of depression is a really robust risk factor for offspring going on to develop depression. Dads are important too, but mom's history of depression appears to be like a particularly strong risk factor. And the literature suggests that like one of the mechanisms by which like a mom having depression and then a kid going on to develop depression, one of those mechanisms might be through like passing on like blunted reward processing or just not sort of responding to rewards. So basically our hypothesis here was that like high risk youth with the moms who have ever been depressed, that they would show like reduced learning from rewards compared to the kids with the moms who hadn't been depressed. So we just wanted to see whether this blunted reward processing is something we see in the kids with the moms with depression.
So how was kind of maternal depression defined? Was it like clinical levels? And just wondered like how you kind of found those kind of mothers for the study.
Yeah. So this was using data again from Tom Alino's TAD study. Tom's a clinician and some other people in the lab are clinicians. So I am not a clinician. So we had moms come into the lab and complete the SCID it's a structured clinical interview for DSM disorders. And this was conducted with trained clinicians. And we counted the mom as having a history of depression if they had ever experienced major depressive disorder or persistent depressive disorder. I think that one used to be called dysthymia, but it's sort of a low-grade chronic depression. But if they had experienced either of those at any time in their life, we counted that as history of depression. And again, just the reason we looked at mom's depression was because that's a really robust factor in offspring going on to develop depression.
Okay. So the mums might not have been in treatment or on medication. It was just through the assessment.
Yeah. So yeah, we didn't, we certainly didn't recruit based on any clinical characteristics of the parents. We just sort of recruited like a broad sample of kids and then we had their moms come in. And as part of the study, the moms completed this clinical interview. And just through, you know, base rates in the population, we got like a fairly large enough sample of kids whose moms endorsed having had depression at some point in their life. But yeah, I don't think we actually got any information about whether they were in treatment or currently or anything like that. Okay. Did reward processing is something we see in the kids with the moms with depression.
Okay. Could you give us like an example of kind of blunted reward processing? What would that look like in a real kind of world context?
Well, anhedonia, the symptom of anhedonia is sort of just blunted reward processing. It's defined as a lack of interest or pleasure in rewards. So it might sort of look like, you know, not responding to a text message from a friend or not being excited about going out to a social event or not being interested in getting good grades or not sort of enjoying, achieving a goal or something like that.
Okay. So, and I guess from a learning perspective, that behavior doesn't get reinforced and therefore it might not happen. You know, that engagement in an activity, for example, might not happen because it's just not as rewarding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's like kind of the idea behind behavioral activation therapy, where they try to increase their engagement with rewarding activities, because if you're not sort of seeking it out, then you don't get that reinforcement and then it becomes a cycle.
Yeah, sure. And so what differences did you see in the reward learning for young people with that family history of depression?
Yeah, so we did have the hypothesis that reward learning measures specifically would be sort of blunted or decreased in the kids with moms with depression. And that's what we saw. So we found lower reward learning rates, again, just meaning that they're updating their expectations less when they get a reward. It's not really changing how they estimate the value for the next time as much in the kids who are high risk for depression. And again, while it's like generally better to have a lower learning rate on this task, you also don't want a learning rate that's like too low, because you need some responsivity to rewards. And what we're seeing here is consistent with like youth who are high risk for depression, just showing like blunted responsivity to rewards.
And what was it? What was the size of that effect? Was it kind of like, was it a kind of very strong effect?
So, yeah, this is kind of a tough question. No, I would say it does not look like a strong effect. But I'm not totally sure how much that is a feature of just the measure itself. Like, learning rate is, it's a reactivity to like each tiny little reward in the environment. And there are also sort of these latent measures. Mathematically, they're like bounded to be sort of between 0 and 1. I don't know. So effect size is kind of an ongoing thing we're thinking about.
Okay. I guess as you were speaking, I was thinking even like a small effect size in a cumulative way would be a massive kind of like from a life perspective could be, you know, absolutely significant.
Yeah, that's kind of how I've been thinking about it, too, is just, if you're just sort of going around in your environment and like you're not sort of, you know, even if you're just a little bit dampened, but it's happening all day long, that would have a big effect.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm just thinking about the implications, really, of the paper. So your paper suggests that these changes may reflect learning becoming more optimized during adolescence. So what can we safely take from that idea? And what do we need to be kind of like careful about in terms of overinterpreting the results?
Yeah, again, this is a really hard question. So it's really hard, I think, to sort of take findings from any specific task and make like big sweeping generalizations about the real world adolescent reward responding. I think sort of it's hard to say also what like optimal learning from rewards in the real world looks like. I think it would depend on goals and preferences for different types of rewards and like the need for different types of reward. You know, if you're hungry, food is more rewarding than if you're full. So I think what we can learn from these tasks is somewhat limited, you know, in relation to like real world stuff. On the other hand, these laboratory tasks, these behavioral tasks are like really controlled. It's really easy to define what optimal performance is. Whereas in life, it's a little hard, right? Depends on the individual. What's great about these tasks is we can define how different measures support like optimal task performance. Like it's very defined. Uh-huh. Optimal task performance is making more money on this task. But I think it's also important to remember that these tasks are very specific, and the way that these measures support success is very specific to the task. So we have to be really careful about like extrapolating our findings from any specific task to make these generalizations. But at the same time, these tasks that we're using, because they do give us so much control over the environment and definition of the parameters, I think it has a lot to tell us. But I think what we're going to need to do over time is to use like a bunch of different learning tasks and sort of get these reward measures out of different tasks and put them together to get an overall picture of how adolescents are responding in different environments.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. I guess it's kind of, you know, you're able to control the variables, but I guess you need more variables to be able to kind of get the generalizability.
Yeah, I think so. I think a really cool new direction that people are going, and I would love to go, is sort of sampling from people's real lives, asking them in real time using their phones what they're expecting from a situation, then how much they enjoyed the situation. And you can apply these models to people's real lives as well as laboratory tasks. And so I think that has some potential to move us into telling us a little more about like real world reward responding.
Okay, yeah, very interesting. Was there any kind of like implications or kind of further research that you want to look at that's kind of been simulated from that part of the study?
Yeah, I mean, let's see. So, I mean, we did find blunted reward learning in the kids with a maternal risk for depression. We know from other studies that if the mom is depressed, there's a higher risk for depression in the kids. But we actually don't have the data. 17 is a little bit young to really see like a full emergence of depression typically. So it'd be really great to like follow, you know, these kids or in another study to sort of see if specifically if blunted reward learning does in fact predict, you know, the onset of depression. And we don't really know that. Instead, we're just sort of seeing kids that we think have a higher risk for depression are showing this effect, but we don't know if this effect then predicts depression itself.
Okay, right. Yeah. So that sounds quite early then, but for potential for future research.
Yeah, I think so.
Cool. And have you got other research in the pipeline? Have you got other sort of studies that you're starting or looking at?
Yeah. So in the same data set, we're looking at the effects of childhood trauma, like different aspects, childhood trauma questionnaires. So physical neglect, emotional neglect, physical and emotional abuse, and how they impact these reward learning measures. It's very preliminary. I think we will find some pretty interesting stuff with this. Here at the University of Minnesota, sort of getting into like neural systems that support these behavioral phenotypes, specifically with Dr. Bart Larson here at Minnesota, we're looking at brain iron. And we know that like brain iron supports dopamine synthesis, and there's this dopamine reward connection. So we're looking at how we can look at brain iron from just fMRI data that's just lying around. Everybody, you know, lots of studies have fMRI data, and we can sort of extract this brain iron measure. And we're looking at how that relates to the different reward learning parameters. Is it related to learning from rewards? Is it related to learning from punishments? Is it related to just a general tendency to push go? So I think these are like exciting studies that I want to see the answers to.
Yeah, brilliant. Excellent. So look, we're coming to the end of the podcast. I wonder whether there's like a final take-home message you'd like to kind of like leave the listeners with.
Yeah. I think this is a really complicating world. That's what it makes it also exciting. I think it's really important to have these like very rich ways of characterizing behavior. You know, using these models lets us not just look at did people choose the rewarding things more, but it lets us look at really specific aspects of how those choices got made. Was it reward informing it? Was it punishment informing it? And I think when we get these really rich behavioral phenotypes, we can sort of start to connect them to specific neural mechanisms. And I think that's really exciting because we can start to think about mechanisms that like underlie mental illness, and that points towards like intervention targets.
Brilliant. Thank you, Holly. Thank you so much for your time. It's been really lovely speaking to you.
Yeah, lovely speaking to you too. Thanks so much for having me.
Great stuff. I really enjoyed this chat with Holly and reflecting on just how complex reward learning actually is and how important it is to look beyond those broad ideas and kind of understand those underlying processes. I think it's also like a reminder about how these laboratory tasks can tell us a lot, but also, as Holly really described well, how careful we need to be about kind of generalizing them. The work sort of still really opens up some exciting questions about how we might better understand reward processing, mental health risk, and the developmental pathways that may shape well-being over time. Plus, I got to learn a new word, anhedonia. So please don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. Also, like on the YouTube channels, search ACAMH, and you'll find us across all of those kind of socials. So join me next week and I'll be speaking to Emma Butler as we discover if sensory processing difficulties in infancy are predictive of child mental health.